One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Katie Weaver, and Gregory Stockel. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Several recent studies have linked additional health problems with what is called long COVID. Long COVID describes a condition in which symptoms of the coronavirus infection remain for a long time. The findings in the studies were recently released and have not yet been fully reviewed or supported by other research. One study, for example, has found a link between long COVID and kidney problems. The researchers examined the health records of more than 1.7 million U.S. veterans. That includes nearly 90,000 patients who had COVID-19 infections and had symptoms lasting at least 30 days. The researchers found that those people were at higher risk for new kidney problems compared to those who had not been infected. This was true even when the people had not been hospitalized. Severe infections resulted in poorer kidney health, the researchers reported. The study was published recently in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. About 5% of the long COVID group developed at least a 30% drop in an important measure of kidney function known as EGFR. People with long COVID were 25% more likely than uninfected people to have a 30% decrease in EGFR. Higher risks were reported in those with more severe COVID-19 cases. The researchers noted that as people age, their kidneys often do not work as well. Dr. Ziad Al-Ali of Washington University in St. Louis helped write the study. He said damage to the patient's kidneys was greater than what happens with normal aging. Another study found that loss of smell may be followed by changes in the ability to smell after a COVID infection. Many people who report losing their sense of smell because of COVID-19 do regain it. But a recent study found that some patients later report smell distortions and unexplained smells. A group of international scientists published their findings in MedArchive. The service publishes early medical research before it is fully reviewed. The researchers examined responses from 1,468 individuals who had COVID-19 between April and September 2020. All had suffered a loss of smell and taste at the start of their sicknesses. Early on, about 10% also reported smell distortions and unexplained smells. At 6 to 7 months after first reporting a loss of smell, 60% of women and 48% of men had regained less than 80% of their pre-sickness ability to smell.
A third study found that one kind of COVID-19 vaccine can produce antibodies even when a person has a weakened immune system. The researchers said mRNA COVID-19 vaccines cause protective immune reactions in most cancer patients with solid cancer growths. They also produced antibodies in people taking medicines that cause their immune systems to weaken. That is what two recent studies in Israel suggest. The researchers found that 6 months after the second shot of the vaccine from Pfizer-BioNTech, 79% of 154 patients with solid cancer growths had developed antibodies. The Pfizer vaccine is an mRNA vaccine, one that uses changed genetic material.
At the same time, 84% of 135 people without cancer developed antibodies. Separately, U.S. researchers studied 133 adults taking medicines that cause a weakened immune system and 53 healthy volunteers. The study found that 3 weeks after the second shot of a vaccine from Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna, nearly 90% of the immune-weakened people had developed antibodies, but many had lower reactions compared to the healthy group. The study was published in Annals of Internal Medicine. Both studies involved a small number of people.
And finally, a separate study on the antibody treatment from Regeneron found a lower rate of hospitalization in patients. People with COVID-19 treated with a monoclonal antibody mixture had lower hospitalization rates than those without the treatment, a study recently said. The patients had mild to moderate COVID-19 cases. The researchers reported the findings in eClinical Medicine. The study was not randomized and cannot prove the treatment caused the better results. But it suggests high-risk patients with mild or moderate COVID-19 may be able to recover without having to go to the hospital. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Technology companies that led the change into remote work when the pandemic started are facing a new difficulty. How, when, or if they should bring employees back into the office. The return to the office has become more difficult because of the spread of the Delta variant. Many tech companies had plans to bring employees back around Labor Day, September 6th. Microsoft, a major tech company, pushed its date to October. Other tech companies like Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and a growing list of others have already decided to wait until next year. Since they influenced starting remote work, tech companies' return to office policies will likely affect other industries. Laura Boudreau is a Columbia University Assistant Economies Professor. She believes these employers' next steps could redefine where and how people work. Boudreaux says, "We have moved past the idea that remote work is a temporary thing." She said, "It has become harder to tell employees they must return to the office after the pandemic." Most tech jobs are perfect for remote work because they involve program and online products. Yet most major tech companies want their employees to be ready to work in the office 2 or 3 days a week at the end of the pandemic. That is because tech companies believe employees who work near each other are more creative. It is one reason why major tech companies have spent billions to build new offices with appealing common areas. Christy Lake is the chief people officer for business programming maker Twilio. She says there is no research to support the idea that people are more creative when they are together. Twilio is not bringing back most of its 6,300 or so employees to its offices until next year. It also plans to permit most of them to decide how often they should come in. Nearly two-thirds of the 200-plus companies that were questioned in July in the Bay Area, the major tech center in California, said they expect their workers to come in the office 2 or 3 days each week. The Bay Area Council is a business policy group that did the research. It found 70% of these employers required their workers to be in the office before the pandemic. Even Zoom, the video calling service that became widely used during the pandemic, says most of its employees want to come into the office part-time. Kelly Steckelberg is Zoom's chief financial officer. She recently wrote, "There isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to returning to the office." But the largest tech companies are not giving their employees a choice. Apple, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft have all made it clear they want most of their workers together some days each week to keep their culture. Ed Zitrin runs a public relations firm representing technology companies. It has been fully remote since it began in 2012. He says the only reason to have an office is to make managers happy, so that they can look at them and feel good about the people that they own, so that they can enjoy that power. Working part-time in the office is perfect for people like Kelly Sutherland. She is a mother of two young children. She works for the travel management company Trip Actions in California. She could not wait to return to the offices in June. She missed the mental break that the one-hour trip to work gave between her personal and professional life. "When I don't have that, I wake up in the morning, I start doing work, and I take my kids to their camp or their daycare," Sutherland says. "And then I come back and I work, and then we pick them up, make dinner, and then I go back to work. So it feels like it's just work all the time. I'm Gregory Stockel.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Lewis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about. But, he says, other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people, and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor. At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man with a spirit strong enough to keep moving even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation. American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.